Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
What is up, everyone? My name is Jacob Minnig, host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today, in this episode, we will be continuing our conversation that we left off from the psychedelic healing episode with Richard O'Bannon and Shannon Duncan. As we all know, we are all in for a great fun time. So without further ado, let's begin part two, healing trauma with psychedelics.
It's interesting that you bring up the whole idea of touch. As far as consent goes, because I know that there was a part in the book that you talked about, again, try not to make too much spoilers, but it's still very relevant in my mind. There is one part in your book that you were talking about somebody that was not emotionally, one of your guides that was not emotionally connected to you at the point, and offering you Xanax to calm you down, and it not being given to you, even though that you probably would have needed it. So can we talk more about the whole consent portion beforehand, what we agree to beforehand, the informed consent part of it, and then how it may shift during the experiential part of the journey? Because that, I think this is a very relevant point, because it's like you have to make this contract. There has to be a contract made between the person giving and the person receiving about what is expected, and then not necessarily changing that dynamic even into the experience. But what happens in that experience is if you need something that you did not consent to beforehand, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. So we're talking about a couple of different things here, but you know, in my own medicine work, I've had two primary guides and I've worked with a few other guides a little bit here and there, just getting the experiences I was looking for. And it was always okay to do body work. It was always okay to, you know, help me get the sensation flowing through my body. So like my first guide would sound a tuning fork and touch it to the bottom of my toes, but he would always ask, you know, so we established before that if body work felt okay at the time, that it was okay with me. So that was the informed consent before. If I had said, no, I really don't want to be touched, it wouldn't have even come up, you know, so that it's honored in that way. And so when body work is offered, I have this option if it feels right to me or not, but I also know that this guide well enough that he's not going to be offended if I don't want it. And so, you know, I've had a guide, like I'm stuck in the process. I feel like I'm just stuck and I'm not moving forward. And he would say, hey, can I work on your belly a little bit? And so he would come and just be pressing down in my belly, which is where we lock down on a lot of emotion, right? And so he would press down on it, and all of a sudden I'd just be, I'd just be bawling, or I'd flip over and start purging or whatever. So that physical contact. And so many times when I, you know, a lot of the trauma that I suffered, I was desperately alone in it. And when it started coming back up, a guide being willing to just put their hand on my chest or over my heart, or if I'm face down, just a kind touch to my back has helped so much in making it safe for those feelings to come up. And if I had just felt like I was just being watched and alone, it probably wouldn't have come up. And so it's just so vital to have a little more freedom. And I understand the challenges with it. I understand that people with their own unhealed wounds that are serving as this guide or as this therapist might take advantage of that vulnerability. And that's something that has to be accounted for. It can't be ignored, but there has to be some room for appropriate consensual touch, appropriate consensual body work for medicine work to really work. Because there are just so many times where it was just too scary for things to come out, or I was just too alone for things to come out, and the touch fixed it. The touch you know, just sometimes with my current guide, I'll just reach out my hand and she'll just take my hand and hold it. And it's everything that I need. I'm not alone anymore. The little boy that was so afraid isn't alone anymore. And so the process of the catharsis can keep moving, and it's removing that from the equation completely is, it's really detrimental to the process. But I also honor and I respect the difficulty in this, because not everybody sitting in that therapist or guide role is going to handle it well. Their own loneliness, their own emotional wounding, their own sexual trauma can leak out into inappropriate touching or taking from that experience when they should be only giving. And it's, I don't have the answer for that. People smarter than me about this need to figure it out. I'm just saying, as somebody who's been through it, it saved the day more times than I can count, more times than I can remember. And it's an important part of the process.
You know, going through the program that I'm going through as a licensed mental health therapist, I don't get any pushback at all for going into psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. In fact, you know, at Adler, I'm welcomed. Everybody has their opinions. Everybody has the way that they think about the whole situation. But I've never really been met with any kind of resistance until the idea of touch comes up. And okay. I don't think that there's really any other topic within psychedelic therapy that carries the weight, that emotional weight. Because on one hand, you have to keep that consent. There always has to be that personal accountability. Always. But on the other hand, there is a real risk of being re-traumatized if that touch is not given in the moment that you need it, as you're talking about, Shannon. And I don't know if there's necessarily any answer yet to get there. You know, me and my wife sat and had an hour-long conversation about this. And one of the ideas that we kind of came up with is, what happens if you hired a massage therapist? I know that there's cost involved. I know that further complicates the situation. But what if you had somebody that was dedicated to just the touch aspect, that is used to working with energy work? What do you think about that?
It's an interesting idea. You know, one of the hard things about giving expression to deep emotional wounding, to trauma, is trust. And, you know, I have had such deep trust with both of my primary guides to let parts of myself out that were so crippled by shame, that it's what caused so much dysfunction in my life. And if there was another party there, I don't know how that would sit with me. It would be a lot harder. Like for me, one of the hardest things ever was crying and letting out sadness, because some of the more diabolical things that happened to me happened because of how I triggered the people around me with my sadness. And, having a second party there would be a challenge. If somebody felt deeply comfortable with both of these people, maybe the massage therapist is somebody they know, or maybe it's their significant other and they have a relationship where they could be that vulnerable with them and they could provide that touch. There's lots of ideas, but it's just, you know, people talk about recording sessions too, and that's like having a third person in the room, and it's such a bad idea. It would be a bad idea for me. I wouldn't let go in the way that I let go if I knew that somebody I don't know could see it and they might have reactions to it that ended up being detrimental to me. It's like having a third party in the room. So I honestly wish I had all these ideas. I would be charging way more for my book if I did. But I can just tell you that touch is a crucial part of the process, and never one time for me has it been inappropriate. And never one time, if I haven't wanted to be touched, has that not been honored. And it has always been a deeply positive, really powerful aspect of the work for me. And so that's the reason, I believe, until the legal channels catch up with how this all really works and they start bringing in people that actually know how this works, not only know how it works, but that have actually done the work themselves, until those people are in here steering the ship, people are still going to go underground to get the help that they really need. And the challenge with going underground is finding people that are qualified to hold that space. That's why I was so exhaustive in the book about showing what qualification looks like and how to identify a lack of qualification.
Yeah.
And that's just such an important part of working underground, plus getting referrals, having an in-person conversation with this person so you can get a real feel for them. You can't do it over text or email. Even video conference, I think, would leave you lacking in getting a real feel for this person. But to get the real deep process that can allow treatment-resistant trauma to give expression, right now it's all underground. That's not saying that people aren't getting profound help from the legal channels. They are. I don't want to steer people away from that. But if you try that and you find that it's not working for you, there is real help, and you just need to be really cautious in how you choose who you work with, because that's everything.
So I got a two-part question.
Yes, sir.
For both of you, help me out. So MAPS is conducting research on MDMA. I think they're done with phase 3 trials.
3B.
So after that, or down the road, will insurances start taking MDMA for therapy?
Yes.
So the second part is qualifications. And I could predict, and correct me if I'm wrong, or it's just a thought, you know, Richard, you know this amongst our field, like there's battles even between therapists on scope of practice, like LPCC, social workers, family therapist. I'm not going to lie. I could see therapists going to battle with the guys and the coaches saying, hey, you're not qualified to do this work.
This is already happening.
Because of a financial thing, in the or there's also the ego of like, I got a master's degree, you got a 6-month certificate or whatnot.
I can speak to that. You know, a lot of the people that have a certificate, they would make probably really good trip sitters. They would make probably, you know, if somebody's just having a hard time getting over a relationship breakup or, you know, it's a couple that are just trying to work through their issues at that level, which is profound work, but it's not medicine work. Profound. That's where you want to shift in perspective so you can see things more clearly and make clear decisions. They might be fine for that. Somebody doing deep medicine work has to be trained, deeply trained and experienced in treating trauma outside of psychedelic therapy work, to be able to take that into psychedelic therapy work. My first guy did not have this. And when we started getting into the more deep, really powerful trauma energy that was starting to move in me, he wasn't holding the space well for me anymore. That's why I moved on to another guy. And that's not taking anything away from him. I did so much growing working with him. I was in and out of suicidal despair in a couple of years before I came across this guy. And he saved my life. He changed my life forever, and I will be forever grateful for that. But it also became really clear at a certain point that we were hitting stuff at a depth that he had never gone to at that similar depth in himself. Even somebody who hasn't been physically abused or sexually abused or hasn't seen the horrors of war, they may not have those same wounds, but they can go to similar depths in themselves. And if they haven't, they can't hold a space for it.
Shannon, what does that look like? What does that look like? He didn't hold the space well, or he wasn't able to.
Great question, Jake.
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. So even in therapy, if you're sitting with a client and you get triggered by something they say, there's an energy in the room that the client can feel.
Yeah.
Turn that up to 1,000. Go from a 5 to 1,000. And that's how it is in a psychedelic session. If your guide gets a little quiet, your guide pulls back a little bit, if your guide has any kind of reaction, no matter how good they are, no matter how much they try to hide it, you feel it. And it's powerful. When you're on psychedelics, it's like somebody hits you in the gut with a sledgehammer. You feel judged. You feel shameful. Yeah. It's powerful. And that's why having done their own deep work is so important, because somebody on psychedelics can say anything. They can say things maybe they wouldn't even mean, but those are just the words that allow the energy to unwind in that moment. And you have to be able to hold a space for it. And if you can't, you're going to do more harm than good. Yes. And so working with my first guide, as we were getting into, I'll just say it, when we were getting into sexual trauma stuff, he would pull back. He would harden up. He was trying his hardest to play the role. But I felt it. And those sessions started feeling more and more punishing. I had more and more fear and more terror being a part of it. I felt more and more exposed and shameful. And as soon as I moved to my new guide, who has worked for years with trauma and is a specialist in dealing with trauma and has done her own deep work around trauma, it was safe all of a sudden. It was safe for this stuff to come out. And that if I had stopped doing medicine work after my first guide, I never would have known more was possible. Mm-hmm. And really, this understanding was a huge impetus in me putting this book together, is that real help is possible, but you need to know how to see what that is. You need to know how to identify it. And the therapists need to know their limits. The guides need to know their limits. And so many don't. There are so many people that have these big experiences on psychedelics, and all of a sudden they get this sense of purpose in their life. This is my purpose, to help people heal with psychedelics. And you know what? God bless them. God bless their beautiful hearts that they want to be of service, but they're doing more harm than good. People are coming to them for help. They're not getting what they're needing, and they're not going back to try again. And, you know, and that's in the most benign of circumstances. Other times they're re-traumatizing these people. They're being judgy. Yeah. They're trying to fix them. Oh. They're trying to play therapist. And, well, because of your relationship with your mother and blah, 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 you know, things real therapists never do. They pull the TV therapist bullshit and they're hurting people. And those are the ones that make me angry. That's when I go off on a rant, because they're doing more harm than good and they need to get the hell out of the way. But, you know, once they start getting, you know, somebody comes in and they've never done psychedelics before and they have this profound experience. And when they come out of it, there's no one else to thank. So they thank the guide. Oh my God, thank you so much. And the guide gets this sense of, this sense of purpose and this sense of validation. And it's addictive. I've watched these people become addicted to the validation. So somebody has
a great syndrome thing. That you said you use the syndrome in the book. It's escaping me now. What is the syndrome?
Are you talking about when somebody thinks they're an expert at something, but they're not? That's the Dunning-Kruger effect.
That's the Dunning-Kruger. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. The Dunning-Kruger effect is when somebody knows a little bit about something and they consider themselves to be an expert because they don't understand that there's this much more to know about it. You know, one of the commonly used examples is a lot of guys think of themselves as great drivers, but they've never been on a racetrack with a professional driver to get a sense of scale of how much they really don't know. And this happens a lot with guides. You know, it's like, well, you know, I give this person this medicine and they come out of it and they're so full of gratitude and there's tears and we feel like it's, I did that. But if the person doesn't have a good experience, well, you did it wrong. You know, it's just, it's the whole guru shtick, and it's really destructive. It's really, really destructive. And oh man, if I could wave a magic wand, those people would get interested in doing something else. It reminds me a lot of back in the day when CrossFit was really big and people were going in and all of a sudden they've got muscles they've never had before and people are checking them out. So they mortgage their house and they go open their own CrossFit gym. Yep. And those are the gyms where people are snapping their spines and ripping their shoulder out because these people have no education in exercise physiology. They have no background in the safe way to put together workouts and everything. Yep. You know, it's just come in and bang it out. And this is where all the energy, it's the same kind of thing. People are getting their sense of purpose at the expense of somebody else getting the opportunity to heal. And that's the part, sorry, that's the part that breaks my heart. You can truly heal with psychedelics, but you can't if you've got some knucklehead playing at being a therapist, playing at being a guide, because it makes them feel good about themselves. Mm-hmm. They're vampires feeding off of other people's trauma, and they need to stop. Mm-hmm. They need to stop.
Thank you for being so open and honest about that. And having the courage enough to actually show podcast.
No shame.
No shame here.
No shame.
I think you're in good company, honestly.
Thank you.
I'd hand you a tissue if I could and a hug. Well, I mean, you bring up so many great points about this whole thing. And it's like, what it comes back to is, it's like, does a, say for instance, you have somebody that is trying to work with you. Does that person need to have deep medicine work that you preach on, almost cynical, for good reason? Do they have to have that medicine work working on their own trauma? Or can they experience their work with their own trauma outside of the medicine work? Because you,
that's a great question. In my own experience, I could only go deep with the medicines. An analogy I used in the book was the depths I was getting to were so heavily defended that the other approaches I've taken were like trying to break into a bank vault with sandpaper, right?
Great.
If somebody is able to go in through other means and heal deep treatment resistant trauma outside of psychedelics, that's amazing. And they should take that experience and that knowledge and that compassion and that understanding into the psychedelic work. But I really believe they need to have also gone deep into those spaces again with psychedelics, so they know what it feels like, they know how it acts, they know how it moves through the body, they know what their client is experiencing. Because nobody can guess at what psychedelics is like. You've either done it or you haven't. You've either gone deep or you haven't. So, you know, somebody who's already gone deep will go deep with psychedelics much more easily, I think. It seems that way. You know, the depths I've gone to that I had to fight tooth and nail to get to, I can go there now quite easily, and they give me access to something deeper. And so they have to have gone deep on psychedelics. It doesn't mean that's where their primary healing needed to happen originally. They might have healed deeply already and then come to psychedelics and then have really deep experiences so they understand it, and then take both of those understandings into work with a client. I'm talking out of my ass. I'm not a therapist. But that's how it feels to me, right? If I were approaching it and I had already done deep healing and I wanted to use psychedelics in this way, I would definitely want to have those experiences on my own so that I know what I'm talking about and I know what energy I'm holding when I'm sitting with somebody. So it feels vitally important to me.
This whole, I think the idea of the container is such a beautiful way of putting it. Because that was my whole thing. Maybe it's a little bit of imposter syndrome that I had reading, because as I was reading your book, it was triggering a lot of emotions for me. Triggering may not be the word. Reverberating, stirring. Like the stirring, maybe like the tuning fork, vibrating. It's like I felt like through the whole book you were hitting a tuning fork, and it just felt like there was huge parts of myself that was vibrating with it. And that was one point that I was like, I'm thinking to myself, I've had a lot of visionary and these expansive states, but I've also had a lot of trauma, being a trauma survivor, complex PTSD, whether it be being raped, whether it was emotional abuse, whether it was psychological abuse, whether it was physical abuse. You know, I've gone there, I've done that, but it was like a lot of that stuff that I've worked outside of psychedelics. So when I hear you talking about creating this container for this deep medicine work to happen, it's like, I've been there, I've worked on this. Am I really good enough to be able to hold a container as a future psychedelic assisted psychotherapist for somebody that has already been there? It's made me check myself. It's like, check yourself before you wreck yourself.
Yeah, good.
And, you know, again, going back to this topic about this guru syndrome that happens, as I've had this deep exploration, I've had these deep knowing of the interconnectedness that exists in all the universe. I know all of these things now. I've reached enlightenment, but it's like, enlightenment doesn't mean dick. It really doesn't. I mean, if you read, like you look at Jack Kornfield, After the Ecstasy of the Laundry. I don't know if either one of you have read that book, but he talks a lot about this. It's like, enlightenment isn't the goal. Enlightenment just gets you to the point where you're trying to assist other people. Enlightenment helps you understand that you have a lot of things that you need to work on for yourself, and you need to stay humble because of that. Because if you do not stay humble, if you think that you're all that in a bag of tricks or chips, to quote that 90s phrase,
Yep.
You can't hold that container for somebody else. No. It's impossible.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about the sense of resonance in reading, and that's really the power of authentic expression, right? It's this book is the most authentic expression of myself I've ever given in my life, but perhaps second only to the authentic expression that comes out in this deep medicine work. But they are a close, it's neck and neck, right? And that's why it's so important that somebody has actually done the experience of going deep within themselves, because that resonance comes through. If somebody is afraid, consciously or not, of going deep in themselves, they're going to hold the client back from doing that too, mm-hmm. unconsciously. And that's why it's so vital. It's so vital that they're not afraid to go there themselves, so they can hold a space for somebody else to do it. And I have spoken to somebody that's getting into psychedelic therapy, and I'm like, what kind of work would you do? And it's like, I wouldn't do that. That's scary. And I'm like,
yeah.
How can you encourage somebody to do something that you yourself are terrified to do? And why aren't you asking questions of yourself of why is that scary in the first place? What's so scary about it? What's holding you back? What are you resisting? You know, if you're not willing to do that learning for yourself, you cannot possibly hold an authentic space for somebody else to do it. And that's the important thing.
That's like encouraging somebody to go skydiving, which I know that you use this mm-hmm. idea in the book. It's like, if you're encouraging somebody to go skydiving, but you won't sit your ass on the edge of the airplane and jump out yourself, yep. you have no business being there. You have no business opening up your mouth to encourage somebody to do that yourself.
It's completely inauthentic, right?
It's a falsehood. It is a straight up falsehood. It's a falsity of the dynamics that make us who we are as an individual. You can't just... And this goes back to this whole idea that we've been talking about. I know this is like long past, probably half an hour ago, but it's this whole idea of how do we expect therapists, psychedelic assisted psychotherapists, to counsel somebody and to encourage them to have these experiences, but they'll never, ever do that themselves. Yeah.
It rings as false. It rings as empty. It's like, you know, I've dealt with therapists as I've looked for therapists to work with outside of medicine work, before medicine work, that loved parroting the latest trendy self-help, psychotherapy ideas out of a book. They're just parroting things that sound good, but they've never actually applied it or used it themselves. And that's never helpful. It is never, ever helpful. Not in therapy, not out in the real world, not in psychedelic medicine work for sure. You have to be able to differentiate between shit that sounds good and what you've actually used and applied in yourself. And that was just so important for me in this book, because there were a few points where I'm like, oh, writing something, I'm like, wait a minute, that sounds good, but I don't apply that. I don't use that like that. And it had to go. It had to go, because this book isn't for me to elevate myself as some kind of an expert. I'm just somebody with deep experience sharing that experience and hoping it'll be of service to somebody else so they can get what they need when they approach this. And if I were just putting in a bunch of nonsense that sounded good, it wouldn't be helpful to them. It would ring as false, and they would probably just take it as a concept and hide behind that concept, you know, use it as a bypass. And so it's just passing the buck of avoiding doing the real work. And so, shit, I don't know where I'm going with all this. It started.
That's all right.
Roll it.
I might be getting podcast fatigue.
So do you think that you could, are people ever, I mean, I guess if we can use the analogy, because I think this whole idea of the therapist / guide / this / that, whatever you want to call it, their impressions, they take their own constructed worldview and then place it on the person that is having these experiences, which is not a good thing. I mean, I think we've already determined that. So it's like when you pull back on this idea, it's like what allowing the person to have their own meaning making in the process.
Yeah.
Without it's necessarily.
It's essential. It's what a guide does in the session, first and foremost, is keep the person safe, helps keep them in a state of mind that is conducive. So if it starts escalating too much fear, you help them get back into the body, back to their breath, and then you leave them the hell alone to keep processing, right? You're holding a safe container. You're a loving witness with no judgment. You're not trying to fix them. You only intervene when you really, really need to, but you're allowing this client's own innate wisdom of how to heal to do its job. You know, you're helping them to open so things can unwind. And if you start sticking your own ideas in there, you're putting things into the cogs of the works. You're giving them stuff to get up in their head about instead of having this physiological unwinding where the traumas are actually held.
So that's more of like,
I agree with you completely.
That's more of like a person-centered approach. It sounds a lot like Carl Rogers a little bit, you know, let them find their own journey. You kind of like waltz with them a little bit, but again, you just do active listening and empathy.
Yeah, you know, during the integration process, more traditional therapeutic models can sit in there. So you can provide a little more guidance, a little more helping them ask the right questions to find their own answers and that kind of thing. But that rarely belongs in a psychedelic therapy session. Mm-hmm. If they ask you a question directly, how you respond is very important. It's important you're not planting ideas, you're not planting seeds, you're not giving them something to grab onto to go hide. Because, man, when fear is moving, when things feel uncertain, when the universe is unraveling at the atomic level, you'll take anything to grab onto to hide. And so it's really important that the therapist is keeping that safe container as, above all, the prime directive, right? It's hold a safe space, let them heal.
Love the Star Trek reference.
There we go. Yeah. Yeah, I was lacking one in the book, I thought.
Yep, I was supposed to pass this on for my wife. She also loved the Star Trek references. I mean, we're huge Trekkies, so I think that's a very, very, very valid point. But Jake, you bring up a very interesting point that triggered something that they actually did a study, and I'm trying to remember which book, because again, I read a lot of freaking books.
Yeah.
But I think it was in one of Stan Grof's books that he talks about how, given the therapist, when the person or the client comes out of the experience, it is interpreted based upon the therapist's theoretical orientation.
Yeah.
So if they're having this, like, say, for instance, you have a Jungian providing the therapy using analytical psychology, all the experiences will be interpreted through a Jungian sense.
Yes.
So, and then vice versa. And then you talk about Carl Rogers and the whole person-centered thing. The problem with Carl Rogers, I love Carl Rogers.
Yep.
I'm not harping on him at all. In fact, one of my favorite psychedelic quotes actually comes from him. But he was too much like a mirror. He only reflected back what it was. And I think that it's important to make the distinction here that a person's experience underneath a psychedelic state is unique to them.
Yeah.
Devoid of the theoretical orientation that you're going to try to define it by. So the minute that you try to go in and try to define or analyze what a person has experiences without your experience or the therapist experience, I think that's also a travesty.
You know, Richard, you made also a good point too. Us being in grad school, like, you develop your own style, your therapeutic interventions. Again, why does a therapist choose the theoretical interventions that they take to the professional life? Usually just because they like it and they applied it to their lives that made it helpful for them to get through their trauma or their mental health issues. Right. For the most part.
No, expand, Jake.
But that's tricky too, because let's say, okay, strength-based CBT worked for me, Adlerian therapy worked for me, person-centered worked for me, REBT or whatever. So I'm going to take those interventions and make them a part of me when I do therapy. Yet again, you're only showing a few sides of a therapeutic realm to help the client. But again, like, something else may help the client, and you got to be aware of that. But again, so many times therapists make their interventions so much a part of their identity, and I think that hinders their ability to help the clients.
Ooh, that's a solid point, man. And you know, and that's one thing that I love about Adlerian thought. And I know I say this time and time again. I probably have said it on this podcast time and time again, but Adler got completely left out of as a foundation of psychology. And it's because his ego wasn't as big as Freud or Jung's.
Yeah.
He didn't have an ego in the game. There was no ego driving him. He was just all in on this concept of meaning making and storytelling from the perspective of the client, not from what can be defined by the therapist. And I think that that's a very valid point. And I, as I've gone through my program, I've tried to take a lot of Adlerian thought and try to integrate it into into psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, because you're not leaving it up to the therapist to derive that meaning, purpose, and belonging. If we want to go down Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but I think that it's important. And I know I've said this again and again, and I'm just repeating myself, but it's like it's important to allow the client, allow the person to have their own experience.
Yeah.
And it is the therapist's jobs to help them understand it, not for them to imprint their own meaning on it.
Yeah. And that's just, especially while under the influence of psychedelics, it's even 1,000 times more important. It is just so crucial to the process, because everybody has their own answers. And it's usually fear that's in the way of being able to see it. Fear of it being true, fear of it not being true, whatever it is, it's everybody's got their own answers and they can come to it. They can have that insight if someone's not yipping in their ear with their own ideas about what's going on. And it tends to be the insecure that need to talk the most. And it's vitally important. And something interesting you were saying there about the big egos being the ones that got the big show. I see that a lot in the psychedelic gold rush space.
Yeah.
It's the big ego with the most,
that's a good way of putting it.
It's the big egos with the least real information, with the most Dunning-Kruger effect going on, that are spouting off the same old banalities over and over again. You know, hey, mushrooms will cure depression, and this will do this and this will do that. And they have no notion. They just want to push this idea of the magic bullet because, you know, they're selling those things or they're promoting those things or whatever it is. And it's the people that really know what's going on are very quiet in that psychedelic gold rush scene. And it's one of the travesties of it, for sure.
You know what I could definitely see is just that, again, as we all know, like, ego pride could be very evil and stuff. I also get the mentality too, like, in our field, like, once you become an LPCC, you know, Richard, you know what this, I feel like you could say whatever the fuck you want and nobody can challenge you, in a sense. That's my personal experience going through like grad school and how I was treated, where all my supervisors, like, whenever, oh, I have this idea, they shut me down. No, like, nope, you're done, whatever. And it's horrible because it's just like, it makes me like, oh God, I can't wait till I get my master's, get my LPCC. And then like people again have that mentality of, okay, look at my degree in the wall. So shut the hell up. I know what I'm talking about. And that is so evil and destructive. And that's like this toxicity that happens in the mental health field. And you think it's crazy. It's just like, you think we would be better than this. And again, I know I'm kind of running a rant about this, but again, I could just people say, don't challenge me. Don't question me. Oh, that's my PhD in the wall. Shut the fuck up. Take your medicine. That's what I got from my superiors. And I'm sorry. Like, some people in grad school and my supervisors, that's how I felt going up the system, and it's horrible.
I'm sorry you had that experience, Jake. I really am, because I've never had that issue.
Not Adler, like, not all the professors. Like, I had some good times at Adler. I also had some really bad times, but again, that's a story for another day. But yeah.
that sounds very traumatic, man. No joke. I mean, there is a differentiation between trauma and just bad experiences per se, but I mean, they, you know, there's a reason why they've always showcased this idea between big T and little T trauma. Of course, you can't say that to a client. Absolutely not. Because that would be putting meaning making from your perspective onto theirs. There has to be complete suspension.
I've had that said to me. I've had that said to me from somebody playing at being a therapist. And, you know, I'm sharing deeply personal things that happened to me, and they go off on the big T little T story. And I'm like, so what are you saying? This is little T. This is the danger of playing at being a therapist. It's just don't do it. It doesn't help anybody ever. it really doesn't help.
You know what the sad thing is? Like, they did research on how going into therapy school, like, there's no indicator of what makes a great therapist. Like, you could be, have a 4.0 GPA, go to grad school and graduate. And then there's a lay person across the street that could go to graduate school and just be just as good or much greater therapist than the 4.0. Like, there's no indicator on how great of a therapist you could be.
Well, I think Bob here over here in the chat brings up a very good question here. Some of these guides have no interest in coming forward. That's absolutely no benefit to them whatsoever.
Yeah, well, you know, some of them can't come forward because they are licensed therapists and participating in this could threaten their license. Some are just afraid to come forward for being ostracized from the larger therapy community. Some don't come forward because they have no business doing this job at all. And they're working with psychedelics in this way and they don't want to be exposed. Yeah, there's lots of reasons why somebody wouldn't come forward, but it's definitely usually the biggest egos that I've seen, especially just since I've wandered back onto social media after being away for 15 years. It's the people putting on the biggest show of expertise tend to have the least to offer.
And usually the ones in power, it's kind of like a boss. It's just you have certain fears. And again, it takes courage to stand up to those people. It takes courage because of what you might lose.
You know? Yeah.
Are we going to go into a conversation about Dr. Carl Hart and his whole opinion about this? I don't know. Are you guys familiar with Dr. Carl Hart?
Oh, yeah. Harm reduction, criminalization.
Well, one of his biggest things is having the courage to come forward about your drug use. Yeah. You know, it's such a dirty word nowadays. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, the amount of people that are in the closet, the amount of people that I have talked to that you would never, ever think that they have used anything at all in their life. And then they start chatting and they divulge, you know, I've met God when I was on mushrooms. It's amazing how many of those stories actually come out. But they will never, ever come out and say that because that is that jeopardizes their reputation in society.
Yeah. It's starting to change. Yeah.
I agree. I think it's important to have those kind of conversations.
Yeah. And it's important that people in respectable positions can share that they had psychedelic experiences that weren't, you know, covered in mud at a music festival, but that were, you know, held in a yurt by somebody that they trusted deeply and they felt like something really profound happened for them and how it turned around and gave a real benefit to their lives. Those kinds of stories are, you know, it's like the kinds of stories I tried to share in Coming Full Circle, just describing my experiences, but also ways that they've genuinely benefited me. It's not this abstract thing. I mean, real concrete ways that my life has changed in profound ways for having gone through these processes. And, you know, for people that hold stations of respect and esteem within society to be able to say, yeah, this did benefit me greatly. It needs to be done carefully. These medicines need to be treated with respect. But I do believe that they have value. I predict over time we're going to see that happening more and more as it gets safer and safer for people to talk about it. And it's going to take some courage. You know, even with my book, you know, I've gotten some really nice book reviews and I've had some people that were clearly biased about psychedelics come back and just trash it. Cliche ridden garbage, I think one of them called my book. And I'm just like,
oh, wow. That is bizarre. That is bizarre. There is nothing cliche about your book at all. I mean, you took me on a ride that I did not expect it at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's just there's the propaganda around the war on drugs is deeply embedded in all of us. I have spoken to people that have personally benefited from doing psychedelic therapeutic work and having expansive psychedelic experiences. And I'll tell them about the work I'm doing and like, careful, you don't make it a crutch. And I'm just like, it's so dyed in the wool that it's going to take a while to get it to rinse out.
Yeah.
So I have a question that I wrote down, and I'm glad that that just triggered the question for me. Yep. Do you think you can become addicted to the healing process? Let me rephrase this. Do you think that the healing process is addictive, not become addicted?
I think, you know, it's like the whole spiritual seekers versus finders thing, right? People that identify as being seekers are going to seek forever, and there's no point in finding because they're not going to be that anymore. I tell you, the millisecond that I don't feel the need to put myself through this process anymore, I'm not fucking doing it anymore. It is exhausting. It is hard. It is painful. If I could never throw up again in my life, I would be so goddamn grateful. I just, it is hard, and I have so much gratitude for it. But I don't want to keep doing this like this forever. Yeah. I would be interested in continuing to have big expansive learning experiences, going and sitting with, you know, various shaman and tribes and indigenous cultures that have been doing this for eons, right? I would love to sit down and see what their experience of it is like. I've got a little more of the deep inner work to do. I'm just right there. I'm doing cleanup. But when I feel complete with this part of it, I have no intention to keep doing this deep dive medicine work stuff again, unless maybe a year later I can feel some remnants that need some more work. But Jesus Christ, no. Yeah. I could see how there are people that are hiding in this psychedelic healing community process. Mm-hmm. They get together in their groups and they sit around and talk the big talk, and then they do mushrooms together. And, you know, that's fine. It's keeping them out of trouble. They're not, you know, knocking over 7-Elevens or anything. So great. You know, stay doing that. But true deep medicine work, hell no. That's like saying you're addicted to chemotherapy. Yeah. It's like, no, you use it when you need it.
Can I quote you on that?
You absolutely.
That's good.
It is hard. It is hard. Mm-hmm. Every time I've been doing this a little over 4 years now, and every single time I'm still shaking. The days leading up to it, I'm trying to talk myself out of it. It is hard. Mm-hmm. It is so worth it. But it is hard, and I would love to go back to just hanging out with friends and camping and tripping on some mushrooms and having a good time. And I'm looking forward to it. I really am. So if you're doing it for real, I don't think there's any addiction potential whatsoever.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
So I kind of want to backtrack a little bit to Carl Hart and that avenue of things. And again, I got like another two-part question. What do you gentlemen think is the biggest barrier? Well, not think, but I'm going to throw out a barrier to psychedelics being a top intervention. AA, 12-step, NA. How do we feel that is a threat to psychedelics?
Oh, that's an easy one. But I'm interested in hearing what Sharon has to say about this.
Because I'm not going to say all that, like, majority of that population hates psychedelic-assisted therapy. You can't take a drug to cure drug addiction.
I have people close to me who have struggled with addiction and have moved beyond addiction, and they found the 12-step program to be helpful, but they don't participate in it anymore. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they've been concerned that, you know, because drugs brought so much misery and so much suffering and cost them so much, they're rightfully very concerned. I've spoken to therapists who work with people addressing addiction issues using psychedelics, and they've told me that that's always a concern, and it's a big hurdle to cross to move into working with psychedelics to heal in this way. And I don't believe, I've never seen any evidence or spoken to anyone to say that, you know, doing the psychedelic process is going to heal. It's all about what you take into it. It's the deep desire, the visceral connection to the desire to move beyond and to address whatever needs to be addressed and face what needs to be faced. And then the psychedelics can help that to happen. but it's just so often they're talked about as a magic bullet, and it's not a magic bullet. None of this is a magic bullet for healing anything. It's just giving you the tools you need to work. I'd be curious of your impressions, Rich.
Well, because I spent a lot of my career like working at treatment centers, and again, I have my opinions of them, especially Minnesota. Sorry, people, DHS, this is just how I feel. I just feel like, yes, like for the client, like they got to have motivation to get better. I just don't think a lot of treatment centers don't do anything. And again, it's not their fault. There could be a lack of experience with the professionals. And you get individuals who are entered treatment who have significant trauma, PTSD, little T's, big T's, or whatever. They have no ability to even start the work to heal that trauma. They're not very in tune with their bodies, like when it comes to like DBT and meditation. So this kind of gets into another question is, what do we think about psychedelics in treatment centers? Like, what would be a safe way to start? I know it's crazy giving clients psychedelics, you know, because I'm going to say this right now. It can't be any fucking worse than treatment centers in Minnesota if you add psychedelics. I'm not apologizing. That's just how I feel.
Yeah, I have, again, people close to me that have people close to me that have gone through treatment centers and gotten absolutely nothing from it. And I'm not saying that no treatment centers are helpful. I've just never had an actual interaction with another human being who tells me that it's been helpful. Psychedelics being available in a treatment center could only help if this person is properly prepared. They're given the internal toolkit to be able to be able to endure their own emotional states. Cause a lot of times addiction is escaping from things that feel too much to be able to be felt. So there's the body-centered therapies. And once they're prepared for that and they are deep inside on board with whatever I got to do, I'm ready to heal, then maybe psychedelics properly held, properly supported could be a real value to them. But, you know, just slipping it into their Kool-Aid is probably not going to help them.
But from what I hear, it's a quicker way to get them to get into that deep emotional mindset through the trauma, because from what I hear, when you're going through psychedelics and you're tripping, you don't experience the trauma like you did in that moment. If that makes sense, those uncomfortable feelings, you look at it through a different lens. Or
it can be, it can be, like with MDMA.
It depends on the medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, MDMA, yes, you could have a gentler experience. Yeah. Mushrooms, you're going through it, but it's, you know, that's why the good support is there. They keep you breathing, keep you in your body, not up in your head, and you allow it to flow through you. And you have a corrective experience that what felt like it was going to kill you before, the emotions, the intensity, you have a corrective experience that, oh, that didn't kill me. Now I don't need to defend against it as hard. And you have a few of those, and all of a sudden the defenses don't become as necessary anymore. That is healing on psychedelics. That's it in a nutshell.
So they're going to get to that state of mind a lot quicker, in my personal opinion, my professional opinion, using MDMA rather than trying to get them to do, I mean, somatic therapy is great, but again, how long is it going to take them with the training, the DBT, the meditation, to get to a state where they are comfortable with those emotions, especially, you know, when you do get into talk therapy, you could very easily get into fight, flight, or freeze mode by telling your story. So again, you need that somatic experience and knowledge to, again, help be more in tune with your emotions. But how long is that going to take?
You need all of those things. Mm-hmm. You need all of the tools in your toolbox to, when you're underneath that, with you're in that expansive state, when you're in an altered state of consciousness, whatever you want to turn it, you need all of those tools. Okay. You need to know how to breathe. Mm-hmm. You need to know what mindfulness is. You need to have somebody that is going to teach you all of those things to help you when you are there. And it's criminally in my opinion, it's criminally negligent to throw somebody into that experience without giving them the tools first to take them there. Because you find yourself like feeling around in the dark. I mean, it's like the worst horror movie that you can possibly experience if you don't have those tools. So you, going back to what you were saying, the question that you were asked about, you know, AA, NA. Let's not forget that Bill Wilson, Bill W., he, at the end of his life, he tried to get the corporation, the organization of AA, to adopt psychedelics. This is not something that's talked about in the history.
No.
Bill W. was a on big it. Proponent of psychedelics. He wanted it to be perceived, but they weren't had it because we're talking about at a time where a drug is a drug is a drug, unless it's caffeine, nicotine, or alcohol. Those ones are okay because that's for the betterment of society. But all the rest of it, you know, screw all of that. So bringing it all together is you need all of the components to help with the treatment of something like alcohol abuse disorder or, you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying?
And I apologize. You know, I don't mean to talk out of terms because again, I've never tried psychedelics. So again, I apologize if I talked out of.
No, it's a valid question. It's a valid from the outside looking in. It's a valid question. And for somebody to truly get the benefit of using psychedelics in a way that is meant to heal them, the more that they are prepared and not just in their head, but in their body, you know, going through the process of somatic body experiencing, you learn to start doing that awareness automatically, right? It becomes muscle memory almost. And it's, so that gets applied in the psychedelic session. And, but more than anything, it's that informed consent that it's not that somebody would slip it to them and hope for the best that they get what they need from it, but it's that it's the ability and the mindset to set a clear intention of what they want from the medicine experience. And from what I've been able, my own experience, it takes a while to build up to that. So you can connect to the parts and have that visceral connection to the part that needs to heal so that you can actually open those lines of communication so the expression can happen. And that just doesn't happen if you kind of plunk somebody down. Great things can happen from just having an MDMA experience, right? You know, my first ever is just the first time I ever had a sense of love or approval for myself was in my mid to late 20s, and I was on MDMA, and all of a sudden I felt it. And I'm like, holy shit, people can feel like this about themselves. And I had no idea it was missing until I felt it. And that was just on, I was out walking around with a friend on MDMA. So powerful things can happen, life-changing things can happen. But when you're looking at dealing with things like trauma and heavy psychological defenses, the better prepared you are, the more you're going to get from it.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I mean, there's that whole thing in transpersonal psychology, and it's not just unique to transpersonal psychology because it's kind of kept in other theoretical orientations, traditions, whatever, is that the therapist isn't the one doing the healing. You're doing the healing. There is an innate healer within us all that does it if allowed to do the healing for ourselves. As long as there's no barriers, as long as we can take down those barriers, our whole psyche can heal itself. It's the job of the therapist to help the individual with that. And if that means somatic type experiences or allowing the energy to move through you to be released, that is where the true healing comes from. It's just like I think it was Stan Groff that gave the example of, it's like, okay, so say you get cut. So you get a cut on your arm. What's the process of healing? What's the process of healing there? You may be able to put a Band-Aid on there. You may be able to do some stitches, but is that actually the part that's doing the healing? It's your body that it does the healing. And so that is exactly the same thing internally, whether it's spiritually, whether it's psychologically. This whole holistic idea is that we know how to heal ourselves. It's just a matter of making sure that we have all of the tools to allow our body to do that work.
A lot of times it's getting the fear out of the way. We get a fear of our own overwhelming emotional states, and then we build internal defense mechanisms against experiencing them. And those are the things that cause us so much trouble in our life, right? Like angry outbursts or whatever it is, sometimes addictions. We're doing anything we can to not feel that particular resonance of emotional state because it's been labeled as dangerous. And so to navigate that fear and allow that emotion to express and have a corrective experience of it, not killing you, not being too much to handle, that's the way healing happens from my perspective. Wasn't it Peter Levine that started the whole somatic body experiencing? Am I remembering his name?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, because that was Peter Levine. What was the book? I even have it. I know what you're talking about, but yes. Yeah,
yeah, so he started the whole somatic body experiencing movement, and or at least as far as I know, I'm not an expert on this, but one of the examples he would use is when an animal is traumatized, the first thing they do is shake. You know, they've got this video of this polar bear that was trank darted and the scientists are poking at him, prodding him, and doing all these things to him. And as soon as he comes out of sedation, he's just shaking like this. And he's saying, look, this is how animals shake off trauma, because they don't intellectualize it. They don't create meaning about it. They shake off this trauma in this way. And I got to tell you, when I've uncorked stuff in therapeutic sessions, I've done the same thing. I've just been arms and legs moving, flailing, kicking. It's just this movement spontaneously happens to release. And so there's really something to it.
Well, yeah. And this goes back to the whole idea of the container. It's like this container could also work with expressive arts. And I'm channeling my wife here, but it's like the whole idea of dancing or being able to draw on a board or, you know, in group work, I mean, standing around a fire, chanting or releasing. What is it? The yelling technique. Primal screaming.
No,
it's allowing your body to do what it needs to do.
Mm-hmm.
It just has to do it. And without that, I don't. And that goes back to the whole criticism of clinical mental health, which thankfully people are coming around. I mean, I'm learning about it now. Yeah. All of those kind of things are embraced. But unless you have a container to do it in and not an office, then it really doesn't mean anything. So what is retreat centers or what does therapy look like in the future? I say it looks like, you know, a therapist having an acreage of land where you can go out and have these experiences, and then you can stand on top of a hill and yell as loud as you can into the void to allow this release, this thing to happen. And then after you're done, you have a group to come back to and you can have an integrative approach. I think that's what a lot of indigenous traditions, that's what it centers around. And I think that we need to go back to that.
I know in my previous episode, they would do, it's ketamine assisted therapy, but it would be also like a couples group therapy where the couples would try maybe it would be MDMA. I don't remember all the details, but then after their experiences, they would all come together in a group and then talk about their experiences with the other couples.
Probably MDMA, because that's probably how MDMA got its start.
Yeah.
They called it Adam. I mean, it's a pathogen. And, you know, it allows the way I always explain it to people is that it expands your window of tolerance. You're able to take in and experience some traumatic memories, traumatic experiences without being overloaded.
Yes.
Without going outside of your window of tolerance. And when you can do that, you're able to process it. And somatic processing is most certainly the way to go. Talk therapy only gets you here. Where somatic processing, the sky's the limit.
Or talk therapy could do worse.
Indeed. Intellectualizing the Tool song, overstimulation makes you numb.
I can't tell you how many clients I've had in treatment centers who are afraid of mental health because of the talking aspect. The therapist is going to try to get me to talk about my trauma, this or that. And I always try to encourage them. Like any therapist worth their salt, especially in trauma, would never do that. There's like a map or curriculum to, again, approach that. They should find out I talked about earlier, how tuned are you with your body and your experiencing of those negative emotions? And then first they go with DBT, relaxation techniques, breathing, to again get you ready for that talk therapy.
Yes.
And it's a shame. I agree.
So I guess the one thing that's not really touched on a whole lot in the book is the whole expansive states of consciousness. Shannon, can you talk a little bit about some of your experiences where you may have had transcended experiences, may have had experiences that would be your own definition of, like, let's say, the divine? And the reason why I ask that is because my personal interest is always in the mystical aspects of people's psychedelic journeys. and how they may define divinity or a higher power or God, whatever you want to use. I'm just
sure.
Is that a megadosing concept, like megadosing to digital states? Okay.
It doesn't have to be, but you often find that complete ego dissolution tends to happen on higher dosages. It was my first ever 5-MeO DMT experience that, you know, for a very long time, I was a bit of a self-proclaimed angry atheist. And mostly what I was doing was rebelling against my family's Christian doctrine, which was just not saying that Christians are hypocritical, but the way my family, you know, beat people over the head with the Bible, while doing the very things they're beating them over the head about, it really put a bad taste in my mouth, and I just had a strong repulsion to it. And my first 5-MeO DMT experience, which was also my very first professionally guided psychedelic experience, just took that off the table. I didn't find anybody's notion of God. I didn't find an attraction to any kind of religion. And it's fine if somebody does. I don't have any opinions about that. You know, whatever somebody's sense of a higher power and sense of spirituality is, that's fine. I don't care. But for me, I had this powerful connection to a sense of what I call all that is this powerful connection to the interwoven fabric of the nature of reality, and how I'm not only an equal part of it, I'm all of it, just as anybody is all of it, you know, and it's all one thing. And it wasn't a thought. It wasn't an idea. I don't need to have beliefs about it. I almost never talk about it. I wouldn't bring it up in a conversation, but it let me relax to know that I belong as much as anybody or anything else belongs. I'm as much a part of all of this as anybody or anything else. And that's really all I need from spirituality, is just knowing that whatever is true, you know, truth exists, whatever is true, and that's good enough for me. And that came from this dissociative experience where all my preconceived notions, all my fears were just out of the way, and I was just in this experience of it. And it was, to say that it was profound is just doesn't come close to describing the experience, because it moved me to my core. And it was also that experience that let me know that I could heal. It's a funny story. So there's two different things called DMT, right? There's NN-DMT, and then there's 5-MeO-DMT. And a lot of people don't know that they're different. NN-DMT, for those that don't know, is this intensely visual experience. Mm-hmm. And if you take enough, you actually leave your body and you travel in another realm and you visit entities. And it sounds amazing. I really want to have an experience of it, right? And I was telling a friend of mine about it, and he said, oh, I know this guy that does DMT ceremonies. And I'm like, sign me up. All right, I'm going. Mm-hmm. And so I went there thinking I was going to get that. But what he was offering was 5-MeO-DMT. Completely different experience. Mm-hmm. The two do not have anything to do with each other. I don't even know why they have the same letters in the name, because it causes a lot of confusion. Yeah. But it blasted my worldview apart. And I was terrified going into it. I'd never been afraid of taking psychedelics before. And so I'm taking a hit on this pipe, and you got to get a 30-second inhale. Yeah. And as soon as it hit me, I knew this is not what I thought it was. Just as soon as it hit me, my body knew, shit, this is something else. And I had this sense like I was being shot out of a cannon. The sense of, it must be what it's like to have one of those really cool Teslas with the super fast acceleration. But I was accelerated and coming apart at the cellular level. And then I was gone. And when I came back, I was on my side and I was sobbing in a way that I've never saw before. And I was just saying over and over again, I'm so alone. I'm so alone. I'm so alone. And it's the first time anything had ever touched that traumatized part of me and let it have a voice. And that's how I knew working with psychedelics in this way was going to help me in a way that nothing had ever helped me before. And it's, it was a beautiful, big, big experience. 5-MeO-DMT is no joke. I work with it a lot in my own therapeutic work, but it is no joke. And people are showing up to be gurus with it, or shamans with it, or whatever it is they're trying to pretend to be, and they're hurting people with it because it opens you deeply in ways that you can't even predict, and you're dealing with the repercussions of that for days or weeks or even months afterwards. And people aren't warned because the people offering these services have no idea. So if you want to play around, if you want to have an experience with 5-MeO-DMT, which I personally highly recommend if you're looking to heal, it's a great way to get the ball rolling, but you got to do it with somebody that knows what they're doing, because they've got to be able to hold that space well.
Not to mention the fact that it can cause death.
If you do it by yourself, you do it with somebody you don't know.
You can aspirate and you can die.
I know. Me and Richard in past episode, we're talking about like certifications, and man, it's tough. Just like hearing, you know, Shannon, you talk about all the things you need to be aware of. You know, what makes a good certification, all the things that they need to cover for therapists to like, just well, for like
to start with basic first aid training, rest position, CPR, clearing the airway. They need to have that down in muscle memory, because it can come up at any time. Purging, you know, laying there on your back and just starting to vomit can happen in a split second on any of these medicines. It's a cathartic purging, and it can just you don't get a lot of lead up. It's just there. And there's a lot to know. And it starts with these basic things. Any training program around psychedelics has to start with first aid, has to. And it's, I don't know. So many don't. So many of these pop-up certifications don't.
And are we going to assume like the MAPS is probably the gold standard?
I would think MAPS is the gold standard.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Rick Doblin knows what's going on. I have to believe he understands the limitations of the current program, because he's worked with psychedelics, but that he's got to start somewhere, and he's got to work within a model that the establishment can understand, and then you expand it over time to be more of what really works for healing trauma. I've yet to see... In speaking with MAPS certified therapists, I've been the most impressed with them over anyone else that I've spoken to. And the care for the clients runs deep, and it's deep and authentic. This isn't some new run for the psychedelic gold rush trying to catch in on an opportunity like you see so much right now. These are professionals that care about the people they're trying to help. And they're doing the best job they can within the limitations put on them. And my earlier discussions around the clinical applications and the shortcomings is in no way meant to put down their efforts. It's just meant to show the limitations of what they're allowed to do.
I think those are valuable critiques. I mean, honestly,
because it's important. It's important.
Yeah, I mean, you highlight this whole idea of Rick having to work within the system. Yeah. And that's the reason why he has got him and his team, I should say, has got to where they are today, is because he's taken bipartisan support on both sides of the aisle, something that can both be agreed on. And that was worth working with veterans. And he has taken all the protocols that has existed since, you know, almost the late 50s, and has turned it into something that is functional, that it works. Yeah. And it's not without all of the criticisms, because you could criticize a lot of things about MAPS,
it's not nothing. And it's important that somebody is spearheading, bringing the ability of these medicines to help heal. And people are being helped going through those clinical trials. I am not trying to say that they're not being helped. Yeah. People are being helped, but there are levels and depths of trauma that aren't going to respond well to being contained in that way. And I'm sure the people in charge at MAPS are on some level aware of this and discussing ways to expand how they can work, expand out, you know, get off the recliner, get off the sofa, get onto a big mat on the floor. Eye masks are optional. You've got speakers, not headphones, so you can move. This ability to let the body do what it needs to do to unwind these traumas that are held on to is so crucial. And I I have not had a conversation with Rick Doblin about it. I've traded a couple of emails with him when he wrote the endorsement for my book, which was
so cool that he did that. That's so
I am
cool.
so grateful for that. It was mm-hmm. like, it was like shooting hoops in your driveway and Michael Jordan coming up and saying, hey, you got a good form going there. You know what I mean?
Yep,
I
was just, exactly.
He was a Hail Mary. I was throwing
shout out to Rick.
And that he would endorse that book meant the world to me. And I don't mean to take anything away from the efforts that those people are doing. They're working really hard to do something good for people. And there's more. And there's more. And for people that need treatment, that need help with treatment-resistant trauma, as I did, they may have to leave that modality to work with somebody off the radar to get the kind of support that they need. But I really believe in my heart that as more therapists come online that have actually done real deep work, that this will start to change. It'll start to shift and it'll evolve into a protocol that anyone can unwind into. Anyone can have deep cathartic releases into. It's all moving, man. It's happening. Mm-hmm. And it's just a matter of keeping the people that know what they're doing like MAPS on the radar and getting the people that don't know what they're doing and just trying to capitalize on the psychedelic gold rush, or they're just trying to have their sense of purpose, getting them off the radar. But unfortunately, they tend to be the ones that are squawking the loudest, and they're the ones that fill the ears of people that are looking for this kind of help. And it's just as a community, we have to start stepping up and just saying, look, man, what you're doing is bullshit and you need to stop it because you're going to hurt people.
You know, it's funny you say that because, you know, some of the biggest problems, especially when you're talking about trying to help people with complex PTSD and then going through the scientific process, is you get things like the expectation effect. Mm-hmm. Is people that go into these studies and you only 50% of them are going to get this treatment. So you have an expectation that, hey, you're going to get this treatment. And what happens is you have suicides and people harming themselves. And it's not from the people that are getting the treatment. It's from the people that don't get the treatment. It's like one woman in one of the MAPS, I think one of the phase trials at MAPS, she ended up hurting herself or committing suicide, if I'm not mistaken. And it was not because she got the MDMA. It's because she didn't get the MDMA because she was expecting to get that treatment. So when you have like double blind placebo trials and then you don't get it. I mean, you're re-traumatizing somebody. Yeah. You're basically dangling a carrot in front of it, and it's not MAPS's fault. They can't control that. It's just what is expected from the FDA and through the scientific process. And then
given an opportunity outside of that to maybe still get the treatment. Once they've shown that the placebo doesn't work the same as the real thing, they still have the option. There are ways that could be handled, but you can't take somebody who's deeply suicidal, somebody who's despondent and on their last.
Yeah.
You know, I at the point where I had that first 5-MeO-DMT experience, I liken my life to back on 9/11. They had these horrific pictures of people jumping out of the building. Yeah. No hope of survival, but they're going to live in a few seconds longer than staying in there. And that's the point why I was when I had this first experience. And if it had been handled by somebody who didn't know what they were doing, if it had ended up being a terrible experience, I sincerely don't know that I'd be here talking to you today. It's just so important that the support you get, especially when you're that vulnerable, especially when it feels like your Hail Mary, it feels like your last chance. Yeah. It's so important that the support you get is qualified and that they follow through and give it to you. I hadn't heard that before, but that is atrocious to put somebody deeply traumatized through a double blind and possibly getting a placebo in that way. And there has to be a better way to handle it. Or after that, let them have the MDMA experience. Yeah. Once you show but just leaving them with nothing that's diabolical. It's criminally negligent. Yeah.
Well, it was suggested. I was listening to South by Southwest when Paul Stamets was giving his his presentation, he was talking about this, and he was talking about going to or being on the advisory boards to some of these corporations that want to institutionalize some of these ideas and into the system. And he would go into the boardroom and ask the board members, raise your hand if you've had a heroic dose. And none of them would raise their hand. So it's like, how do you expect them to facilitate healing and medicine work if the people that are in charge are just in it for the money?
Exactly.
That doesn't make any damn sense. I mean, we're talking about two sides to the same damn coin, is that we're trying to get capitalism involved, and we're also talking about the scientific method, and neither one is really facilitating or getting to the heart of what it means to actually heal somebody, or heal trauma for that matter.
That's the whole reason I took the time to write this book. You know, I'm not somebody that really likes to be in the public eye. I'm somebody that likes to be quiet at home and practice my piano and play guitar and walk around the house singing. Yes. And so my dogs can listen. And, you know, I just, I like my solitude. I like my privacy. I like spending time with my family and my close friends. And honestly, it's been really stressful being out here, but nobody else is speaking up. Nobody's speaking up. Nobody's protecting these people that are looking for help. And if I've got to start that movement, if I've got to show that you can do it and survive, that it's okay, then so be it. But somebody has to speak up, and it can start with us. Yep. It can start with us speaking up and just not staying quiet in the face of ridiculous nonsense that's happening. And hopefully if we do it, then more people will do it.
I agree. It's the many voices into the mass. I mean, that's how it starts. The parts are always greater than the whole.
Yeah.
Each individual voice that kind of contributes to this conversation, you know, brings up conversations that we really need to have in such a divisive world. I mean, we're so polarized in our thinking that everybody's afraid to have that conversation across the aisle to somebody that may have a point that they may disagree with. And I think true wisdom and understanding comes with this idea that maybe somebody has a point that is better than yours. And it's okay for you to change your mind based upon the new information that is given.
If somebody can share with me ways to make medicine work more effective, I want to know about it.
Right.
You know, if I can lessen the burden on myself and get the same or better results, I want to know. You know, what I've come to has come from hard-earned experience and working with truly talented people that know what they're doing. But there's more to learn. There's more to learn, especially on the expansive side, especially on the, you know, the true, not these knuckleheads that call themselves shamans, but the true shamanic side of exploring with medicine work. I am intensely curious about that. And I would love to work with true shaman to see what else is possible in the expansive side of medicine, of working with psychedelics. It's really important to keep an open mind and be willing to learn and to do better.
So, you know, there's this whole idea in Adlerian thought, again, that doesn't get talked about enough, is the whole idea of social interest. And this kind of goes hand in hand with the idea of the wounded healer. Is once that you have healed from your own trauma, that you want to help others heal from theirs.
Exactly.
So what's your next step, Shane? You wrote this beautiful, wonderful book that everybody should buy. Go to the website, by the way, or Amazon or Audible. And thank you. I want to thank you for narrating your own book. That's the Joe Rogan advice right there. I love that. So what's the next step for you? What do you want to do?
You know, I want to keep getting this message out. I want to keep helping people to understand that real help is available if it's right for you. I want you to do your own internal, you know, checking. I want you to use your own discernment. I want you to educate yourself. And if you do go out to seek help, I want you to understand what real help looks like so you can get what you need and actually benefit from the experience. So I've got more podcasts to do. I've got a PR person that's been out there lining these things up for me and interviews and whatever. I would just want to continue getting this the word out about this. Hopefully other people will start standing up and pointing out what's not working and what is working and helping to bring more of what is working into the world. And, you know, when that happens, I'll probably just go back to my quiet life. That's mm-hmm. what I appreciate. I do have another book or two in me. There's more I want to talk about specifically. I really want to do some work or do some writing around doing deep shadow work with psychedelics.
Yeah, my man.
I have a you know, just that one chapter, and it was mm-hmm. just by necessity kept very simple, but there's so much more to it. Yep. And it's such an amazing model. It's just, you know, it's just another way of thinking about your internal world, right? You gotta put it into ways your mind can understand. Otherwise it's just a fog in there, right? mm-hmm. And shadow work is so potent. It's so helpful. And especially when you start bringing in ideas of the scapegoat and all the other nuances mm-hmm. to working with a shadow. And I really want to bring that into a context of exploring it with the help of psychedelics. I've done a lot of that already in the medicine work I'm doing, but I'm going to start moving into doing that very specifically with psychedelics, as the trauma stuff that I needed to work through has largely been put to rest. Mm-hmm. I have a few other ideas, so I'd like to write some more. But for this first stretch, I'm going to be pretty vocal. I'd like to keep being on more podcasts. I enjoy this. I've really enjoyed mm-hmm. talking with you guys and being here with you. And I'll just put it out to the universe that it would be really nice to talk with Joe Rogan. And you know, if I could actually put out another person, I would love to have a conversation with, it would be Jordan Peterson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my man.
He understands the value of corrective experiences, and everything I talk about in the book is corrective experiences. And, you know, setting any political notions around Jordan aside, he's a brilliant man, and he knows mm-hmm. what he's talking about around psychological principles. Yeah. And I would just love to know his thoughts on what I've written and how we could talk and maybe come up with some new ideas to make things better. That's it for me for right now. It's my job is just really trying to help people have a good, safe, effective experience with healing with psychedelics.
Well, was it Rick on Joe Rogan's show a few times too?
I think Dobbin? So. Yeah.
He's had him a couple
well,
times.
I mean, yeah. There's several Ricks. So you got Rick Doblin, you have Rick Strassman. Yeah. I'm hoping to become one of those Ricks. that's a high standard to live up to, but Rick Doblin was on 2 weeks ago.
Well, yeah.
I think it would be a really interesting conversation with Joe because he's on board with psychedelics. Yep. I might have some points of view he hasn't considered before, especially with the deep medicine work stuff. Maybe he has. I haven't heard him talk about it. And it'd just be cool to hang out with that guy for a few hours and talk. I think that would be really cool. No.
Sit around and drink Buffalo Trace in Texas.
Right?
Well, I know that you don't drink anymore, but the Buffalo Trace is like, I could sit there and have some bourbon with Joe Rogan.
You're right.
Well, and you mentioned that the whole shadow work. I mean, you want to talk to somebody that knows more about Jungian analytical psychology than anybody. It's definitely Jordan. Talk about somebody mm-hmm. that's wrestled with his own shadows.
And his own shadows.
Definitely.
Cool. Well, this has been awesome, guys. I've just really enjoyed this, and maybe we can talk again another time. It's just, there's lots
absolutely.
To discuss. I've really enjoyed having this conversation with you.
Richard,
go ahead, Jake.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, would you gentlemen like to give the audience your contact information so they can get a hold of you?
Sure. You can go to email. Yeah, you can go to shannonduncan.com and I've got a contact form there, and I will do my best to respond to anything that doesn't seem troll-like.
And I'll put the links to your books on my show notes too.
Cool. Thank you. Appreciate that.
I'm a nobody. I don't have any letters by my name.
Not true.
All I do is like to sit here and talk about psychedelics. I'm a student.
You're going to have MA at the end of your name soon.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. I think it's important to humble myself over and over again. I'll let my future work speak for itself. If you want to get a hold of me, I'm on Facebook. You could probably reach me by email. I know that's probably not a good idea to release personal emails, but richard.d.obannon@gmail.com. It's pretty, there's no hyphen in the O'Bannon. So, or apostrophe. So don't don't, you mean, go ahead, reach out to me, but I'll be around. You know me.
Excellent. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. This is great.
I again want to thank Shannon and Richard for being awesome and amazing special guests on my show. It was truly a great learning experience, and I cannot wait to have them on again. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support. And just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behaviorhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behaviorhealthintegration.org. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called Calmigo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to, again, help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.